time hour. In the meantime, happy St. Patrick's Day to all of you folks. Just wanted to play maybe a little Sinead O'Connor for you while we're waiting for Greg Giorgio to call us in. So let's take a listen.
I want to talk about Ireland. Specifically, I want to talk about the famine, about the fact that there never really was one. There was no famine. See, Irish people were only allowed to eat potatoes. All of the other food, meat, fish and vegetables were shipped out of the country under armed guard to England while the Irish people starved. And then, in the middle of all this, they gave us money not to teach our children Irish. And so we lost our history. And this is what I think is still hurting me. You see, we're like a child that's been battered, has to drive itself out of its head because it's frightened, still feels all the painful feelings. But they lose contact with the memory, and this leads to massive self-destruction, alcoholism, drug addiction, all desperate attempts at running. And in its worst form becomes actual killing. And if there ever is gonna be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding. You mustn't kill more than 10% of the nation, because to do so causes permanent psychological damage. It's not permanent, but they didn't know that. Anyway, during the supposed famine, we lost a lot more than 10% of our nation through deaths on land or in ships of emigration. But what finally broke us is not starvation, no, it's using the controlling of our education. Schools go on about Black 47, on and on about the terrible famine. But what they don't say is, in truth, there really never was one.
Forgive.
That was Sinead O'Connor, and that was off the Universal Mother CD. And we just played it live off of YouTube. There's an amazing video also that goes along with that. So right on, Sinead. And we have on the phone with us, hopefully, we'll be joined by Greg Giorgio. Let's see if we can get him on now. Greg, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. So glad that you could call in today.
My pleasure.
So, Greg, just to let people know, I'm Christina Malisoff. We're listening to the second hour of Tell It Like It Is. As a special for St. Patrick's Day, as usual, I like to try to tie things into something political and educational. I asked Greg if he could come on to talk a little bit about James Connolly. And first of all, let me tell you a little bit about who Greg Giorgio is. He is a delegate for the James Connolly Upstate Regional General Membership Branch of the IWW, which is the International Workers of the World. He has been a member of that organization in good standing for 19 years. He is a work-life announcer, reporter, and producer for Capital OTB Cable TV and Radio from 1976 to 2010, and organized AFSCME Local 2055 unit there in 1988. My goodness, there's a lot here to read. Member of the Capital District Solidarity Committee, Hudson Mohawk May Day Committee, U.S. Labor Against the War, Good Friday Coalition Peace Vigil, and past member of the Capital District Labor Religion Coalition. And he has also hosted and produced The Labor Show, which is, I think, where I first met you, Greg, on WRPI, which was between the years of 1997 and 2008.
Those are the bookmarks.
Yeah, of quite a life. And
happily retired now from 34 years of wage slavery.
I hear you. Yes, but still going strong politically.
Yeah, I'm serving on the executive board of the IWW this year, and I'm keeping real busy with administrative duties, which is not usually my my forte. But I was nominated and ran and was elected to a position, and it's kind of exciting. Our union is doing some interesting stuff. I guess we can talk about that later too.
Well, actually, I really wanted to start with if you could tell us, the folks who are listening, briefly what the IWW is. I know it's a tough one to do briefly, but
yeah.
It's people may not really know what that union is. It's a special union.
Well, I would characterize it as being unique because the IWW is since 1905, when the union came together in Chicago, was organized by a coalition of socialists and trade unionists for the most part, who saw a need in the era of the robber baron. Shall we say the classic era of the robber baron? We're sort of in another era of robber barons now again.
Mm-hmm.
They never really went away. And they saw a need for labor to respond in such a way that would unify workers across the craft lines. The IWW is organized as an industrial union outfit. We believe that all workers in one industry belong in the same union, and that those unions should consolidate themselves into one big union. And it is sort of a utopian vision of how the labor movement should address its problems, but we do think that it's a more efficient way to deal with the problems that workers have in addressing the abuses of their employers. And it also, the IWW is also a union that has a vision that says that capitalism cannot be a reformed entity. It has to be abolished. We don't believe that the wage slavery, the wage system, is a just way to try to repay workers for what they do. Labor produces all, and we should have the industrial system should be controlled by labor, because they do the work and they take the risks. And we feel that society should be built along industrial lines, because politically we have seen time and time again over centuries how the masters of industry have controlled the political system, and from a fairly early start of their consolidation of their power, and that where our power lies as workers is industrially.
Mm-hmm.
And so we believe, just quickly, we believe in a system of industrial unionism versus craft unionism, which is how most of the other union federations are organized in this country and around the world, where, again, something I mentioned very early, that all workers in one industry should belong to the same union. We shouldn't split individual job categories into smaller and smaller factions of unions that often conflict with each other in terms of how they organize themselves. They often cross each other's picket lines when there are disputes, things like that, which are very detrimental, not only in the union movement and labor in general, but it's a societal problem that causes resentment among workers and keeps working class people fighting among themselves, which the boss class is very good at keeping us doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you're saying industrialism versus craft unions. You're talking about, again, well, you said it very clearly, one large union which wouldn't be splintered by what craft unions, you're saying, particular specialties?
In other words, you could use an example. Say you go into a typical manufacturing firm. I could cite one, actually. There was a strike in our area in Glens Falls about 10 or 12 years ago, paper-making operations. There were about 9 different unions in the same plant that tried to negotiate with the company over issues of, of pay and working conditions at a time when the company was trying to divide the workers. And part of the problem that they had, and they eventually lost the strike, by the way, and part of the problem that they had was that they had 9 different bargaining committees trying to meld into one. And so it creates a problem of coordination, and it creates a problem of where you're always going to have resentment between different factions in a workplace when you have different unions that have jurisdictions over different jobs. And so I, looking from the outside in, and I would not want to say that those workers were, I'm not trying to cast aspersions on their tactics, but it's a system that's set up to fail in many cases. And so, the old industrial unionists used to say that this was a more scientific way to manage our working affairs, and I have to agree with them on that. That the other way is sort of a recipe for disaster when there are crises that the employers are going to foist on us at any given time. And it's always unexpected.
Right.
Right.
I've got a quick question though. When you talk about industrialism, there's very little industry left in this country. A lot of the trade unions, for instance, in Wisconsin, are what they call the professional unions, teachers and firefighters, more service, the service industries, and you're including that under the aegis of industrialism.
Yeah, because industrial just simply means we are. The old Wobblies, the IWW members are called Wobblies in many cases. That's the old nickname. The old Wobblies used to say, where are our loyalties in terms of how we orient ourselves in the international way? Are we loyal to a nation state, or are we loyal to our class identity?
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a huge distinction in terms of how people view themselves. Most people view themselves as some sort of citizen of a nation or a region or some kind of state, like we're citizens of New York State if we reside here and work here and so forth. But the old Wobblies used to say they were citizens of industry, because industry was, anything that had to do with working for a living was industrial, and that's where the workplace was where we were robbed from, and that's where we had to struggle at. So we were citizens of industry, and the international boundaries and the local boundaries really didn't mean that much.
I want to touch on that, the international boundaries, very quickly. because right during the and in continuous strikes right now in Wisconsin and actually throughout the Midwest, there was a support from workers.
There are protests, but they haven't really struck yet.
No, they haven't. Well, there's been calls for a general strike, but that's another issue. But there was support on the part of workers in Egypt, which a lot of people didn't realize that prior to the uprising in Egypt, there was a lot of labor unrest that was going on for years amongst Egyptian workers. So there was a connection where Egyptian workers were actually sending out their support and solidarity to workers who were protesting in Wisconsin. And is that part of the international consciousness you're talking about?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, the watchword, the watch phrase at the IWW is always used in its literature and in many of its campaigns over the years to try to organize workers, was that an injury to one is an injury to all. It really is comes from a long lineage of moral parables that are both religious and practical in society. The old Knights of Labor in the after the Civil War in the 1800s used to say, "The concern of one shall be the concern of all." And so the IWW adopted that into a phrase called "an injury to one is an injury to all." And I'll say that workers around the world very often are more conscious of what's going on in other countries and the problems with their workers than workers in this country are in the reverse mode. And so to have that heartening effort of those Egyptian workers to have sent aid to Wisconsin and solidarity messages to Wisconsin, that's a lesson that people should take heed of. It's an important point that's been sort of washed over.
Right.
And, you know, the IWW maintains an International Solidarity Commission, which I served on 5 or 6 years ago. And it's an important internal body of the union that keeps an eye on other workers' struggles and tries to create cross-border connections between those workers and ourselves here.
So very quickly, I wanted to ask about a little bit more about this idea of an international working class consciousness, because I think during the Clinton period with NAFTA and a lot of industry leaving this country to go to other countries where unions weren't as strong or regulations over environmental pollution or workplace regulations where workers weren't injured or you didn't have child labor, all those things. There seemed to be a worldwide drift of labor or capitalist or industrialist going to places where there were no unions or where there was not as much strength in workers having something to defend them from horrible work conditions.
Well, you know, and again, it's been going on. It happens cyclically. In a capitalist economy, it seems to have accelerated through legislative deals like NAFTA. And by the way, you know, those of you that are political junkies, do your homework. What issue did Bill Clinton work on the hardest in his entire 8 years of administration? Answer: NAFTA. He personally lobbied dozens of congressmen to get that bill paid, get that bill passed.
Yeah.
And he was not as active on any other issue in his administration, personally, as he was on NAFTA. And it tells you a lot about where these political parties are at.
Democrat,
you know,
or Republican.
No, you know, it's a useless distinction anymore. You'll get in arguments with all your and I don't mean to, I guess I'll keep saying this, right? I don't want to insult anybody who calls themselves a liberal. But I've gotten into many arguments with liberals over this distinction thing, and these two parties are—they're a double-headed snake of the same evil body, and they need to be—they need to get a wake-up call. But
well, that goes back to what you were initially saying: is that you can't really reform capitalism. I mean, there's arguments now. I think Chris Hedges has talked about this that. It can only go so far. It's almost like an apology, and it puts off the inevitable
Yes.
Conflict. And I just want to, before we go to our main topic, which is the discussion of James Connolly, I wanted to ask, how do you organize workers in this country to become more aware of who they are? Because I think we, in the last couple of Tell It Like It Is shows, we keep hitting this topic of people in this country not really knowing where their interests lie. And there's a number of reasons for that. Maybe because they think they're conned into thinking that they can be the one who's going to be successful, and if they play right with the system, they're going to make it. Or it could be due to racism. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think we have a couple of huge problems in terms of how people are socialized in our country, in many countries around the world. The educational system does not allow people to have alternative views that would somehow counter the mainstream ideology of whatever government they're in. And we have the modern media has created a consumerist society that has become very turned in on itself. Mm-hmm. I have to say that I'm not that optimistic. I always say that I won't let the government change me. I don't know that if I can change the government, mm-hmm. because we have dug ourselves a huge hole. However, I would also say that I don't think historically it's ever been true that those who keep their nose clean and their nose to the grindstone, so to speak, are always necessarily the ones who get ahead. We have a lot of mythology right. in our society that sort of backs that up. And sure, cosmetically, you can name a half a dozen of your friends who have worked hard and done well financially or somehow have some status in our society. But what did they sacrifice? It's no good to sacrifice your time, your energy, your personal relationships, and even your own soul to have a little more money in your pocket. Workers in a system that exploits them more and more are gonna revolt sooner or later. I don't know how soon it's gonna happen. We may have the germ. The germination of it happening right now in the Midwest, but I'm not all that optimistic about it. The unions in Wisconsin are looking, the leadership of the unions are looking for a political decision to try to fix their problems, and it really needs to be a direct action decision to fix their problems. The only historically true fix for these problems is when workers withdraw their efficiency in the labor market and cause the system to disrupt. And I don't mean to sound like, you know, some sort of tactical, I don't know what you would call it, but that really is historically how workers have won their rights. It's historically, look at the civil rights movement. It was a mass aggregation of civil disobedience, and that's how we advanced an agenda that created some laws in this country. And laws are not what they're cracked up to be, but we still need them. Right. We still need a framework. You know, I'm not a total nihilist.
Right.
They might call me something else, but I'm not a nihilist. And we do need a framework to try to jump off from, or to try to build on. And mass civil disobedience is a nice formula. It can work. It's been proved time and time again. By the way, Gandhi and Dr. King were not tolerant people. I think there's a misconception in this country about how we're supposed to react to injustices and things that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to make that little point.
Could you elaborate on what you just said? Because it's a very good point, because people see Gandhi and King as being complete pacifists, but they actually put it on the line. They put themselves on the line, and they were pacifists, but they evoked a reaction.
Well, you know, there's a difference between pacifism, mm-hmm. which wants to ideally eliminate violence from the formula of action, versus passivity, which is what happens when you are afraid to act properly.
Mm-hmm.
And so they embodied pacifism. They embraced it, but they also did not tolerate those who were creating injustice. They took every opportunity they had in almost every case I can think of to decry and denounce those who were doing the things that they thought were the worst injustices. And so we have political correctness in our activist life now, where we can't say anything against anybody for fear that we might alienate sometimes our own enemies. I don't get that. So Dr. King and Mahatma and those kind of people, I think they had their head on straight about what to tolerate and what not to tolerate in terms of the degree.
I just want to remind people that they're listening to Tell It Like It Is, which is a weekly program on Thursdays at 10 a.m. With Christina Malisoff, that's myself, and my co-host Sam Sebring. And we are on from 10 to 12 every Thursday. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 on your FM dial, Acre, Hudson, Catskill, hands-on radio. And we are now talking to Greg Giorgio, who is an international worker of the world.
That's industrial.
Industrial.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just another very brief question before we go to our discussion today of James Connolly.
Sure.
There's also, when you were talking about what keeps workers in this country from identifying with their own interests, there's also the issue of economic inequality in this country. And with that kind of inequality, economic inequality, there can never be really social justice. At the same time, there's this tremendous fear of the idea of socialism or the word socialism. How do you put those two things together?
Well, you know, we have socialism for the rich. People just don't understand that they're being sold a negative on that idea if you're not rich. And so all of the financial advantages and all of the government handouts go to people who already have a lot of money. And that would be a form of socialist economics. And so I think people have to get their head on straight about how they might organize their society better so that the distribution of wealth was, you know, more equitable. And let's face it, almost every political discussion we're having in this country today, and I would say in historically this has been true for the most part, we're always, if you strip it down bare, we're always talking about a problem that is related to the distribution of wealth. The money is there. It's been stolen, it's been rearranged, it's been hidden, and it's been taken right out of our pockets. And so you got to wonder when people are going to get angry enough to want to take it back because it's their money.
Yeah, it's almost like people are suffering from amnesia because all of a sudden everybody has forgotten that Wall Street initially got us into this financial crisis, which was paid for with taxpayer money, and now all the states are adopting austerity budgets. Which we're all going to immediately swallow the austerity budgets and cut back on benefits and wages because we have to pay back the banks?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's incredible. Yeah, I'm incredulous. I don't understand how people don't get the quid pro quo here, the direct relationship between the two.
Yeah, and it's not just to cut back on wages and benefits, but also the whole infrastructure of the country is going to be, we're talking about money for infrastructure that is going to be ignored, and we're talking about quality of life, the keeping up of our cities and our schools or and our hospitals are going to really suffer during this period if we don't do something.
And of course, I think the listeners of your station may understand how the process moves forward, because what we're seeing is a demonization of all kinds of working people, particularly those in the public sector. And, you know, I have my antennas up for that because I was a public sector worker for 34 years.
Mm-hmm.
I worked under the Taylor Law. I couldn't legally strike under New York state law. I mean, you can do it, but, you know, it's hard to try to get people to agree to go to jail or to lose 2 days' pay for every day that you create a job action of some sort. But, we're, you know, to take teachers and other administrative workers and state workers and municipal workers to task for having so-called a better deal, which in many cases is an absolute falsehood. Most private sector jobs actually pay more than most public sector jobs. There's been several studies that have come out, even in the mainstream press, that have bore this out. But yet, we have been able, as a society, we're able to swallow the argument of these false arguments about where the problem lies. Mm. It's an after the fact use of false data to cover a previous problem, and it's a bold deception. I have to say that you know, like Governor Walker of Wisconsin is I don't know if bold is the right word. I would say, you know, he's taken a page of the playbook out of Nazi fascist Europe before World War II. I mean, that's pretty much how you you create your cabal of industry and government is by, you know, stripping workers of whatever rights they already have.
Right. No, it's a very good point. Well, we're moving right along with time, so we better get to our main theme, which is James Connolly. So if you could give us an introduction, Greg, it would be wonderful.
Well, you know, James Connolly was, he's known as, in many circles, as one of the Irish martyrs of the Easter Rising of 1916, when sort of a social revolution led by the workers of Ireland tried to topple British rule. But he goes much deeper than just that end point, which he is most known for. He was born of Irish parents in Scotland in 1868. He actually didn't spend that much of his life in Ireland, even though he was of Irish descent. He actually spent a lot of his time here in the United States in terms of his political and working life. And James Connolly, as you pointed out earlier, our local IWW branch in the upstate New York area is named after him. He was a member of the IWW for a number of years, and he actually settled in Troy, New York for a short period of time.
Where there's a statue of him, I believe.
Yeah, the next to the Uncle Sam statue is a statue of James Connolly in the Riverfront Park area. Connolly lived in a couple of spots. One of them was on Ingalls Avenue in Troy, and I think that one house is now gone. But he actually worked as an insurance salesman when he lived in Troy. But he was already active in the socialist movement, helping to organize the Irish Socialists, Irish Republican Socialist Party, and the Irish Labor Party, both before and after he lived here in Troy, New York. He became a member of the IWW in 1905. He came from working class background. Unlike a lot of other people who were identified as socialist leaders of the time, he actually did come from a poor family.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a widely read man. He was very highly educated as a self-educated person. He was an early feminist. He believed that the union movement and society in general was holding women back.
Interesting.
He advocated for women to be in positions of authority in the organizations that he belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
He was a multilingualist. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was an early IWW organizer, helped create the American Civil Liberties Union and later became a leader of the Communist Party USA. She recalls a time when they were doing a speaking tour to try to organize workers for the IWW. And there were a lot of Italians there, a lot of Italian immigrants, most of whom did not speak English, if at all. And she was worried because she didn't speak Italian, and she told Connolly with concern, "I don't know how we're going to be able to communicate with the Italians." And Connolly told her, "Well, we'll figure it out. Someone will speak up." And when it was time to continue speaking and to try to get his word in, he got up and spoke fluent Italian.
Amazing.
He also spoke German, and he was highly regarded wherever he went. He classified himself as a socialist. His particular take on it was that he was in favor of a socialist type parliamentary system, but he also did not believe that the politicians, even if they were socialist or more to the left than the mainstream politicians, should try to organize the revolution. You know, he was a revolutionist. He wanted a more equal distribution of wealth in the society. He believed in workers' rights from day one, but he believed that the workers needed to give the party the impetus and not the other way around. As a matter mm-hmm. of fact, he had a little bit of a running battle with Daniel DeLeon, who was also one of the early founders of the IWW and was the leader of the Socialist Labor Party in this country. And at some point fairly early on in the IWW history, in 1908, about 3 years after the union was formed, DeLeon split from the IWW with a faction because he thought they were going too far away from using the political weapon in their ability to try to organize a new society. And Connolly sided with the anarcho-syndicalist faction of the union, which didn't believe in endorsing political candidates and didn't want to work in the political field. They felt that everything had to happen on the industrial end of things. And interestingly enough, Connolly, who was not an anarchist or really an anarcho-syndicalist, he did side with that other faction, and he really, if you describe his most basic, and he characterized it this way, his most basic attitude toward how society should function is that he was a syndicalist. He believed that the unions should have the say in how the industries were run.
Is that what syndicalist means? Because some people might not know what...
Essentially, yes. You know, if you look at the history of some of the European unions, for instance, the revolution in Spain in the 1930s, the Spanish... those that fought for the Spanish Republic against Franco, they were syndicalists. Those were syndicalist unions, the CNT being the most prominent of them. They believe that workers should create the impetus to control the industries and move the economy from there.
So from the bottom up, not from the top down.
Absolutely.
And so hence the anarcho portion of it, because some people feel as you said, no matter who the politician, whatever the political persuasion, once you have that amount of organization or bureaucracy, it becomes problematic.
Yeah, I mean, at its most basic level, I think you've hit it on the head there. To rely on the politicians to carry on the program that we've already sort of figured out for ourselves was always sort of an anathema to a lot of the syndicalist unions, those that exist elsewhere, and the IWW early on decided that it didn't want to have affiliations with any political organizations. It also is very clear organizationally that we do not, we're also not in favor of those who would prohibit political activity. Members are free to exercise their own political will as individuals, but they just can't do it as part of their identity and their function in the union.
Okay. All right. Well, yes. Okay. So returning back to James.
Yes. So Connolly, I mean, I think, you know, some of his words are pretty powerful. He said things, his sort of philosophy about industrial unionism, he was very strong in speaking of it. He said, the principle of complete unity in the industrial plane must be unceasingly sought after. The industrial union embracing all workers in each industry must replace the multiplicity of unions which now hamper and restrict our operations, multiply our expenses, and divide our forces in the face of the mutual enemy. With the industrial union as our principle of action, branches can be formed to give expression to the need for effective supervision of the affairs of the workshop, shipyard, dock, or railway, each branch to consist of the man and woman now associated in labor upon the same technical basis as our craft unions of today. And he also went on to say, you know, he was also a bit of a nationalist Irish patriot, you know. He very strongly identified with the struggle in the context of British imperialism and the suppression of the Irish working class. He said, organized, as stated in industrial unions, would be a calculated effort to secure the highest form of industrial efficiency combined with the greatest amount of individual freedom from state despotism. And he later got himself in trouble, I think, by being an Irish nationalist, wanting to put forth the needs of an Irish state before maybe primarily or ahead of the needs of the Irish workers. But, you know, they both sort of happened at the same time in the Easter Uprising of 1916, mm-hmm. as he helped lead the Transport and General Workers Union with Big Jim Larkin. But he also told people in that struggle, hang on to your guns, because it did become a physical battle of weapons with the British Army.
Right.
And the reason he said that is because he didn't trust that after a certain part of the battle may be over, that some of the people didn't go over to the other side and try to repress the working class element that was so strong in that uprising. So he was fearful. You know, he was an interesting guy of complex, you know, reactions and feelings about these issues.
Yeah. Was there any involvement, was there any crossover from British workers to in support of the Irish Rebellion?
Well, you know, I have to say that I'm probably not qualified to give you that answer.
I'm just curious.
I would think that because of the political climate of the time, it was likely, but it would have been a pretty chancy proposition to cross over that side at that time. But you know, there's always somebody who's got the conscience to want to fight what they believe is the right fight at that time, the right struggle.
Right. Well, I ask that because it seems that it's interesting how sometimes nationalism, in terms of people's ideology or consciousness, how that nationalism seems to trump, the bigger connection, which is that we're all the international workers' connection. It's a thing that divides people. If people understood that that borders between countries are artificial, we could really have a tremendous strength. I think.
I can't argue with that, and I think Connolly saw that. Mm. And again, he had sort of a mixed bag on this. He also saw the need. I think my take on it is that he feared that without the Irish identity, that the Irish working class would not be as unified. I think he assessed it properly on mm-hmm. the ground where he was. But the economic threat was very threatening to the hierarchy. It's interesting to note that when the Irish Republic was established, The new constitution, the new laws, reflected Connolly and Larkin's wishes for a recognition of worker rights as being a foundation. And so even though he gave his life and ultimately, you know, you could say that he partly failed because he really did succeed in a lot of ways, he and those who struggled with him, you can see that his influence was large. While the movement that he was in was repressed and defeated on a certain level, it lived on in the Irish Constitution.
Mm-hmm. There's a quote here, which is that I downloaded from the Industrial Workers of the World. Some more information on James Connolly.
It's a nice website, isn't
it? It is, yes. And so if folks want to go to that, they can go to www.iww.org/culture and biography, or whatever else you want to look at. But the final quote I was going to read was, "A revolution will only be achieved when the ordinary people of the world, us, the working class, get up off our knees and take back what is rightfully ours." I think what I'd like to also have you talk about is this. People are very fearful of the word socialism or communism, because it's been identified with some pretty regimes that have been very, I don't know, they're horrible regimes, such as Cambodia's Pol Pot, or some of the old Soviet Union. As time went on, people realized, people who even supported the Soviet Union realized that there was a lot of repression going on, and there's in China still a bit, you know, a lot of that left. So how would people understand when we call for a change in the world or a revolution? How can we talk about that without bringing up the old fears of these other kind of regimes?
Well, it's difficult. Mm. I think you have to learn from the mistakes of those regimes. Connolly was a clairvoyant in his statement, "Hold on to your guns." I think he had a suspicion of those who would come into power. He was an anti-authoritarian at his heart, I believe. Mm-hmm. And he died before these worker revolutions, these socialist-based revolutions that came after 1916, could have informed something of his sensibility at that time. So I think, you know, I would use my own union's model, that we have a highly democratic system. We're sort of a do-it-yourself union. We have a lot of local autonomy. We don't need a regional or national boss in the union to try to guide us as to how we think a local matter should be handled. We have a one worker, one vote local democracy in all of our branches and job shops and different bodies within the union. We have a delegate system for our convention, which carries proxies of all the members. We used to have a more direct democracy convention every year. We've sort of changed that, at least for now, and I actually hope we go back to the old system. But we have a very democratic structure, and so anytime you want to create change in your area or in the greater society, if people don't have a direct say in it, and that is hard to manage. I'm not pretending to say here that this is just an easy, quick fix, but we need to have the model of one worker, one vote.
Mm. Absolutely. Which is a true democracy, not a representational democracy.
Right, and Connolly also spoke to that. He felt that representational democracies were false democracy, mm-hmm. and that the true democracy would be an industrial unionist system of government where the workers controlled industry and would force any parliamentary government to yield to their interests rather than the other way around.
Well, I think that would be a good place to end our discussion of James Connolly, and I just want to thank you, Greg Giorgio, for coming on Tell It Like It Is.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I hope we can get the chance to do it again soon.
Thank you so much, and we'll hopefully be talking to you soon. And I'll just say goodbye.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
with you. I want to comfort you. I want to comfort you. Just letting your tears run wild. Like when you were a child. I'll do what I can do. I wanna comfort you. You put the weight on me. You put the weight on me. You put the weight on me. Much too much for me. I'll do the same thing that you do. And I'll put the weight on you. I'll put the weight on you. Wanna come for you.